Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Friday the 16th of February, these are our main stories. Israel says it's detained suspects and seized weapons during its raid on a key hospital in Gaza. A doctor there gave us his account.
Every minute we have new sanctions from the Israeli army side. And now the Israeli army, they are invading and shooting inside.
The US confirms it's monitoring what it calls an anti-satellite weapon developed by the Russians. Also, up in the air. Crying babies on planes spark a heated debate. Also in this podcast.
Never got any money, can't go out, everything's expensive now.
My salary at work's gone down, so I've stopped going out to buy clothes and eating out in order to save money.
Japan and the UK go into recession. And Greek MPs have voted in favour of legalising same-sex marriage and adoption. The Israeli army says it's detained dozens of Hamas gunmen and found weapons, including explosives and mortars, after entering Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The IDF said it's been carrying out a precise and limited operation which would ensure that patients and medics were safe, with no need for patients to evacuate the complex. But medical staff inside Nasser Hospital described chaos and shooting. They reported that at least one person had died and several others were injured and that they'd been forced to flee. Khaled Alser is a surgeon at the hospital.
Shootings, bombings, every minute and every hour we have new sanctions from the Israeli army side. Since the early morning, they communicated with the head of the administration of the hospital to move all the patients into one building. It was very difficult because the only patients left is patients who are unable to walk. And now the Israeli army, they are invading and shooting inside every floor in the building.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, was listening to the latest briefing on the Nasser hospital raid by IDF spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
He said that dozens of Hamas gunmen had been detained inside the hospital. The Israeli military has been interrogating some of those that they have captured. Daniel Hagari named three of them. He said one of them was a Hamas ambulance driver who had already confessed to transporting an Israeli hostage from Israel into Gaza on October the 7th. He also said that as a result of the interrogations that have been going on during the day and coupled with testimony from former hostages who have been released, the Israeli military is now confident that Israeli hostages were indeed held inside Nasser Hospital at one stage, and also that the bodies of dead hostages had also been stored. He did add, however, that no evidence of hostages alive or dead had yet been found and that the search was still going on.
Of course, the Israeli version of events is at odds to reports from the medics there, some of whom are saying that Israeli troops had fired into a ward, killing one patient and injuring others.
Yes, we've had no confirmation of that from the Israelis. They say that they are looking into those reports. We don't often hear back in cases like this. Clearly, this was an armed incursion into a hospital by special forces, into a place where they believed that Hamas gunmen were lurking. And so consequently, they will have gone in, guns blazing, if you like, expecting to encounter resistance. And so perhaps it is not surprising that for the civilians, the patients, the medical staff who were in the building at the time, they would have been privy to a pretty unpleasant experience, to say the least. The hospital has not been evacuated. We saw civilians moving away from the area this morning. That suggests that they were heeding Israeli warnings for civilians to leave. But we think there are still a few hundred patients and staff inside the hospital. And we saw a video earlier this evening of patients crammed into one of the corridors of the hospital. We don't yet know exactly how well Nasser Hospital will be able to continue to function after this raid is over. Maybe it will.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. The difficulties faced by Ukraine's military were front and centre of a NATO defence minister's meeting, which ended on Thursday. Speaking at the meeting, the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, said that Washington's delay in approving a much-needed $60 billion US military aid package to Ukraine was already having an effect on the country's war effort. Mr. Stoltenberg confirmed that some allies were aiming to provide Ukraine with 1 million drones. So far, 7 NATO members, plus Sweden, have said they'll join the group, led by Latvia and Britain. Our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale, reports from the NATO meeting in Brussels.
In background briefings, NATO officials admit that Ukrainian commanders on the ground are now having to make very tough decisions because of shortages of ammunition. One senior official admitted there were worries in Ukraine about running out, not just of artillery shells, but also air defence munitions. That's why the head of NATO said it was so important that the US Congress approves President Biden's package of military aid. It has been passed by the Senate, but not yet the House of Representatives. Jens Stoltenberg made clear the delay was already hurting Ukraine, and he said he expected Congress to break the impasse.
The fact that the US has not been able to make a decision so far has already had consequences. It is impacting the flow of support. To some extent, this can be compensated by increased support from other allies. And the European allies and Canada are stepping up. But the United States being by far the biggest ally, of course, it's vital that they continue to provide support.
There have been pledges of more military support at this meeting in Brussels. Britain said it would lead a coalition which aimed to deliver thousands of drones to Ukraine. But it's America that's been leading this effort. And its internal politics is not just hurting Ukraine, but also raising wider questions about America's relationship with NATO. Not least because Donald Trump has once again appeared to doubt its very purpose, that an attack on one ally would prompt a response from all.
Jonathan Beale in Brussels. The White House has confirmed it believes that Russia is developing a new anti-satellite weapon, saying it's closely monitoring the situation. There's been widespread speculation in US news media about the alleged threat after a cryptic social media post from a member of Congress on Wednesday. From Washington, here's our correspondent, John Sudworth.
The White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby said the US has known for many months that Russia is trying to develop a new anti-satellite weapon, adding that it was being taken very, very seriously. It first came to light in a social media post from the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Republican Representative Mike Turner, in which he spoke of a serious threat and called on President Joe Biden to declassify it. US news reports quoting unnamed officials have since claimed that it relates to the deployment of a space-based nuclear weapon, which would use radiation to knock out satellites, a detail neither confirmed nor denied by Mr. Kirby. He stressed that the weapon was still under development and denied a Russian claim that the reports were a deliberate ploy to pressure Congress to approve aid to Ukraine.
John Sudworth. Well, let's hear more of Mr. Kirby's views on what the Russians are developing.
This is not an active capability that's been deployed. And though Russia's pursuit of this particular capability is troubling, there is no immediate threat to anyone's safety. We are not talking about a weapon that can be used to attack human beings or cause physical destruction here on Earth. That said, we've been closely monitoring this Russian activity, and we will continue to take it very seriously.
Juliana Zeus is a research analyst for space security at the Royal United Services Institute here in London. She also hosts the podcast War in Space, and she's been speaking to Johnny Diamond.
What we think that this satellite specifically might be, it's research dating back to 2019, is that the Russians are looking to develop a nuclear reactor that could be used for jammers in orbit. So that would be a satellite used for electronic warfare to disrupt other satellite signals.
So battles breaking out in space with nuclear weapons flying hither and thither, you think that is unrealistic?
If we talk about red lines, just a conventional kinetic attack is a red line in space. Right. And a sort of nuclear detonation in space is another couple of degrees further from that. So it would be entirely unprecedented. And what we mustn't forget, nuclear detonations are indiscriminate. So this would wreak havoc on orbits, but also all other satellites around. So it would also have huge implications for the attacker themselves. So this is why I think it's on the less likely side.
If we do end up with a Russian nuclear-powered satellite with jamming capabilities, I mean, presumably the other side would want to respond. Does one side have more to lose than the other when it comes to satellite capabilities?
Yes, absolutely. So the West is very reliant on space for its military capabilities. Russia has less to lose in space. That's partly because their space industry has suffered massively, specifically because of sanctions that have obviously been in place since 2014. But in general, the space industry is not in a good spot. And as a result, their space capability are definitely lagging behind that of the West. Therefore, I would argue Russia has less to lose in space. On the other hand, a large-scale destruction would not benefit anybody.
Juliana Zeus speaking to Johnny Diamond. Donald Trump is about to become the first former U.S. president to stand trial on criminal charges. A judge in New York has ruled the trial on his hush money case will start on the 25th of March. In the case, Mr. Trump is accused of misreporting payments to the porn actress Stormy Daniels in exchange for her silence over their affair in the run-up to the 2016 election. Mr. Trump denies any wrongdoing, and as he left the court in Manhattan, the former president said the case was politically motivated.
Instead of being in South Carolina and other states campaigning, I'm stuck here. It's an election interference case. Nobody's ever seen anything like it in this country. It's a disgrace. We'll just have to figure it out. I'll be here during the day and I'll be campaigning during the night. Biden should be doing the same thing, but he'll be sleeping. This is all from the DOJ. This all comes out of Washington.
Well, it's not illegal in the US to pay someone compensation in exchange for a non-disclosure agreement. I asked our correspondent in New York, Neda Tofik, what is the prosecution's case?
What of these 34 felony counts really stem from is what prosecutors allege was falsifying business records. They say that Donald Trump, in reimbursing his fixer Michael Cohen, who paid Stormy Daniels, the former porn star, $130,000, that was actually recorded as legal fees, that they didn't come forward and say that they were for campaign contributions. So prosecutors allege that this was to help his campaign, to hide the fact that there was an affair. It's interesting because Donald Trump and his lawyers argue that these aren't felonies. He says there is no crime, but we'll have to see what the jury decides in this case, which we now know will start March 25th.
Mr. Trump has pleaded not guilty to all charges, but what sentences could he face if found guilty?
I mean, look, he could theoretically face up to 4 years in prison. But what we've heard from legal experts is that's highly unlikely here, particularly now that this would be the first criminal trial he faces. We've certainly seen him in New York in court for civil cases. Those claims that this is all election interference now kind of common from those appearances in New York. But this would be the first criminal case. So if he is indeed convicted, it would amount to kind of his first offenses. So jail time is really unlikely. Likely here. What legal experts suggest is he could just face fines in this case, if anything.
Well, there is another case involving him in Georgia today, wasn't there? What happened there?
That's a really interesting hearing because it's actually almost attached to his case, but separate. Now, Donald Trump, of course, in Georgia is accused by prosecutors from Fulton County of trying to overturn Joe Biden's win in that state. They show the phone call with the Secretary of State, for example, where he's asked to find 11,000 votes in his favor. The hearing was actually about the district attorney herself and whether she had an improper romantic relationship with the case's top prosecutor, Nathan Wade. So they're hearing evidence about when that relationship began and if it has any impact to the point where they need to take her off the case.
Neda Tofik in New York. And now to a sound we feel we must apologise for in advance. Allegations of a child crying for an entire 29-hour flight have lit up the internet after one man's TikTok went viral, hitting 14.5 million views and sparking a furious debate, as Stephanie Prentice now reports.
Rate my 29-hour flight to Berlin.
The video, a man staring into the camera close up, one eye twitching. The scene, what he calls a 29-hour flight from New Zealand to Berlin. The soundtrack, this. Musician Henry Beasley's viral video cuts through different close-ups of him responding to what he says was non-stop crying, using captions to rate each one. This, for example, is described as a nice long one here. And this is titled Kettles Boiled. Many of the 2.8 million people who liked the video are using the comment section to emphatically call for child-free flights. Thousands of others have sympathised with the parents' plight.
I know it sucks, but I promise you that nobody is more miserable than the parent of that child. They know.
If I'm on a 29-hour flight, I know I'm just going to have to deal with it because can't nothing mama can do.
Some have even dug up an old video of a man on a Southwest airline having a meltdown of his own over a crying baby.
Why is the baby yelling? Yelling. So is the baby!
Okay, so you're a man.
Others showed a time passengers banded together to sing to an inconsolable toddler. As for Henry Beasley, despite his suffering, the video ends on a happy note with a final rating on the screen saying, incredible stamina, 10 out of 10.
The joys of flying. Stephanie Prentice reporting. Still to come on the Global News podcast, Manchester United break the record for the most expensive football team in history.
This figure doesn't include Rasmus Højlund, Mason Mount or Andre Onana, all signed during the transfer window ahead of this season. Their squad has actually increased in value, some would argue maybe possibly not in quality.
Senegal's Constitutional Council has ruled that the postponement of presidential elections, scheduled for later this month, is unlawful. Last week, President Macky Sall announced he was delaying the elections due to disputes over the eligibility of some opposition candidates. The decision has led to street protests in one of Africa's most stable democracies. Our West Africa correspondent, Myeni Jones, has more.
Senegal's Constitutional Council ensures that any laws passed are in line with the constitution. Therefore, the fact that it says that pushing back this month's presidential elections to December is unlawful is a big blow to President Macky Sall. It's not clear what Mr. Sall will do next, but his opponents will see this latest decision as vindication. There's been strong opposition to the delay in Senegal. Protesters have taken to the streets, and opposition candidates and lawmakers have filed a number of legal challenges against it. Critics of President Sall accuse him of launching an institutional coup. Strong words in a region that has been rocked by a number of military takeovers in the past 4 years. Senegal has never had a coup, unlike all of its neighbours. Regional bodies and Western powers have expressed concerns at the delay of the polls.
Myeni Jones. In Greece, celebrations outside Parliament in Athens on Thursday evening, as Greece became the first Christian Orthodox majority country to legalise same-sex marriage. The bill was introduced by the Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis.
Today is a day of joy, because from tomorrow one more barrier between us will be lifted, and it will become a bridge of coexistence in a free society with free citizens.
Our Southern Europe correspondent Mark Lowen told me more about how the vote went.
Well, 176 MPs voted in favour, Val, and 76 voted against, but there were about 46 MPs who marked themselves as absent from the chamber. Now, those are likely to be MPs from the governing party of Kyriakos Mitsotakis, who basically ducked the vote in order to, in effect, register their disapproval without having to vote against it. So it shows that, you know, he didn't have the support of the whole of his party behind him, but he had enough opposition MPs to vote with him in order to get the vote through. And, you know, he's in a very strong position. He stormed to re-election recently. He has managed to pass now a bill which traditionally is something that would be associated associated with centre-left governments, same-sex marriage, but he's a centre-right prime minister who feels that it is time for Greece to fall in line with much of the European Union. 15 EU countries already allow same-sex marriage. Greece will now be the 16th, and it will be the first Orthodox majority country and the first country in Southeast Europe to allow it.
What about reaction across Greek society, and particularly from the Orthodox Church in the country, which opposed this, didn't it?
Very vehemently so. I mean, some bishops said that they would not baptise the children of same-sex families in order to teach them about, as they put it, the sin. They read out their condemnation of the move in church services across the country earlier in the month. And polls before the vote was passed showed that society was pretty evenly split for and against, a slight majority in favour of the bill. So I think this marks a rare moment in which Greece's politicians have stood up to the Orthodox Church, which is still very powerful, and it is a moment when the Greek government has decided that this was the way forward and they have to now drag society with the law.
Mark Lewin. Japan has unexpectedly fallen into a recession after its economy shrank for two quarters in a row. Market watchers had expected the new data to reveal positive growth rather than another quarter of declining output. Japanese households have been struggling to keep heads above water.
Of course, it's regrettable. I don't like thinking that Japan will gradually decline.
My salary at work's gone down, so I've stopped going out to buy clothes and eating out in order to save money.
The recession and weakness of the yen against the dollar suggests Japan has now fallen behind Germany as the world's third largest economy. So, what's gone wrong? Peter Landers, the Tokyo bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal, explained to Sam Fenwick.
Consumer spending in Japan continues to be weak, largely because wages are going up, but they're being outpaced by inflation, and that tends to encourage people to be cautious about spending. The weekend should help exports, and in fact has helped exports from Japan, because it makes these Japanese-made products more competitive. In dollar terms, Japanese workers are making a lot less than they used to. The weak currency means that Japanese people are paying more for imports like oil or food. That's taking a bigger bite out of their paychecks and leaving less for other purchases. Consumer spending in general is not a particularly strong when you take inflation into account.
Do you think it's a blip, or do you think that this is a trend?
I think this is a blip. It may be technically a recession by one definition, but it doesn't mean that we're in a Great Depression here by any means. I think the economy is just roughly flat.
Tell us what's happening on the stock market, because I think that shows a different picture, doesn't it?
It really does form a contrast to see wages are going down still in Japan, whereas the stock market is going way up. I think in the last 3 or 4 months, you've seen it go up by more than 20%, mainly driven by foreign investors who are encouraged by what they see in corporate Japan, and corporate profits are up strongly. So you do have companies making more money, especially those that are taking advantage of the weekend to export more. High-tech industries, there seems to be, you know, an expected boom in semiconductors, artificial intelligence. So foreign stock investors are very excited about the potential for Japanese companies, but you don't see that excitement in the consumer spending figures.
So what needs to happen, do you think, to get those consumers spending again?
We do see a lot of companies talking about big wages increases starting last year. Retailing, the parent of Uniqlo, said it might raise wages as much as 40%. Other companies like Suntory talking about 7% wage increases, which if carried out would certainly exceed the inflation rate in Japan. Right in the next month or two, we're going to get a lot of information about how companies are raising wages and whether those raises are enough to exceed inflation. If that happens, I think you'll see people saying, now I can spend a little bit more, and you'll see much healthier overall growth figures.
Peter Landers talking there to Sam Fenwick. Well, another one of the world's richest economies has also gone into recession, and that's the UK, as Darshini David reports.
Be it manufacturing, construction or retail, all the major sectors fared worse than expected at the end of 2023, as higher inflation and interest rates took their toll on finances and spending. Two consecutive quarters of falling output were sufficient for many economists to claim a recession. But the economy was effectively flatlining ahead of that. The typical person was the equivalent of £140 worse off by the end of 2023 than they were at the start of 2022. For many, like these shoppers in Essex, it's been painful.
Never got any money, can't go out, everything's expensive now.
Really feel the increase of the cost of the food and everything. Even we went to the food bank.
Yeah, I am very worried about spending, especially when it comes to things like electricity and gas, yeah. Diesel and petrol.
The The Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, acknowledged it had been a challenging environment, but said he was optimistic the dip may have been short-lived.
The turning point will come when inflation falls to its target level of 2% and the Bank of England feels it can bring down interest rates.
The jobs market remains resilient and wage growth is on average outpacing inflation. But over a million households are set to remortgage this year. Their debt repayments will be higher than they have been. So, across the economy as a whole, the pace of improvement could be modest.
Darshini David. Fresh computer modelling indicates that up to half of the critical Amazon forest cover could be pushed into an irreversible collapse by 2050. The research published in the journal Nature is said to be the most comprehensive analysis yet of the threat faced by the world's largest tropical rainforest. It warns of dire consequences. Henna Handal is a climate and policy researcher at the Stanford School of Medicine, and she's been speaking to Victoria Owenhunda.
You know, when we talk about the Amazon rainforest, I think we need to remember that this is the world's largest tropical rainforest. It's home to 1 in 10 known species on the planet. And so what this type of a study showed us is that ecosystems like these are resilient, but they also need to be kept in a delicate balance. And the study mentioned 4 key factors: droughts, fires, deforestation, and rising temperatures that are really overburdening the Amazon. And that's why I think it's so critical that we ramp up all efforts to protect this precious, precious ecosystem, because millions of people in Brazil rely on it, and the world relies on it for its stabilizing effects on our climate.
And how does this forest decline affect the rest of the planet?
So the Amazon is actually really critical for its cooling effect that is important for the globe. It also functions as a carbon sink, storing more than 120 billion tons of carbon. And right now you're seeing so many different disruptions to the Amazon. You're seeing lots of deforestation, diminished rainfall happening, particularly between June and November. So it's a devastating picture all around. And just recently, there were some droughts that were really destructive to the local population. Actually, the state of Amazonas had to declare a state of emergency and deliver food, water, and essential supplies to local communities. So a lot of people locally rely on the Amazon for its resources, but globally, certainly, it has very important climactic consequences.
So, Henna, is it just all doom and gloom, or is there a ray of hope somewhere here?
I think the ray of hope resides in international collaboration. And what we saw at the United Nations Climate Change Conference last year, COP28, we saw Brazil's President Lula, Colombia's President Petro, and Honduras' President Castro, along with other leaders in Central and South America, really come together and talk about the need for climate justice, the need for the so-called Global North to support the Global South in their climate efforts in order to prevent catastrophes like what we're potentially witnessing happen to the Amazon. I think we need to look toward that arm for international collaboration.
Henna Handal, a specialist in how to contain the effects of climate disasters at the Stanford School of Medicine in the United States. New figures have revealed that last season's Manchester United squad cost a combined total of $1.5 billion. That's the most money ever spent on a football team. Despite this, United have struggled for footballing success. Rachel Wright asked football expert Nigel Adderley what they've spent all this money on.
They signed players such as Antony, Harry Maguire, Jadon Sancho and Casemiro, all for fees close to $100 million individually. And this figure doesn't include players such as Rasmus Højlund, Mason Mount or Andre Onana, all signed during the transfer window ahead of this season. So their squad has actually increased in value, although some would argue maybe possibly not in quality.
Has this money been well spent then? And does it breach any rules?
Well, in terms of financial fair play, Manchester United are such a global brand with such a huge turnover that even though they do have the most expensive squad ever assembled, they are still within financial fair play, because wherever you go in the world, you can find someone wearing a Manchester United shirt. Those shirts all generate money, and they also have sponsorship deals with various companies in different parts of the world. So they have the money to spend, but have they spent it well? That is another question because Manchester United have not won the Premier League since 2013. They've since been overtaken by a number of clubs, including their neighbours Manchester City. And there has been an accusation towards Manchester United over many years now that they are signing players, possibly for the value they can bring to the market, for the number of shirts they can sell. And they tend to sign players and then think about how they will fit into the team. And really, to be a successful club in the long term, it should be the other way around.
Of course, Manchester United aren't the only massive spenders, are they? You mentioned Manchester City, and there's plenty more in the Premier League.
Yes, Manchester City and Chelsea both have squads which have cost way in excess of $1 billion. But Manchester City do have a very established squad now, and they are very clever in the way they recruit their players. Erling Haaland, their main striker, was signed from Borussia Dortmund, but only for a fee of around $75 million, which seems a bit of a bargain because they often exploit the opportunity to sign players with release clauses in their contracts. So although Manchester City have the best team, it's been acquired over a number of years. And unlike Manchester United currently, they are not trying to play catch-up. But interestingly, the figures UEFA have released today does not include the $1 billion that Chelsea have spent on their squad over the past 12 months since they were taken over by the American billionaire Todd Boehly. So Chelsea could very soon have the most expensively assembled squad ever and with a similar lack of current success.
Football expert Nigel Adderley speaking there to Rachel Wright. And finally, London's famous tube map is getting a makeover with the introduction of new names and colours for its six overground lines. Until now, they've been marked by a series of orange lines, but each will now be rebranded to make the network more accessible and to pay tribute to the capital's history. With more details, here's Graham Satchell.
Dreams have become reality at Wembley.
The moment in 2022 when England's women won the Euros at Wembley. The overground service that runs through Wembley is now being renamed and will be called the Lioness Line. Other parts of the overground network are also getting new names to celebrate London's culture and history.
This specially woven bathing suit is the very latest for the beach and has marvellous sea and sun resisting properties.
What's it made of?
Wool.
The Weaver Line runs through parts of the capital associated with the textile trade.
London is the place for me.
The Windrush Line passes through areas with strong ties to Caribbean communities, including Dalston Junction, Peckham Rye and West Croydon. The struggle for women's rights and its connection to the East End is the inspiration for the Suffragette Line. Emma Strain from Transport for London says the names were chosen after extensive consultation.
We spoke to customers, historians, industry experts, community groups. Lots of names came up. We discovered lots of things and stories about London. And then we looked at all of those and thought, actually, how do we represent London's communities and London's stories?
The Overground Network is hugely popular, with 180 million passengers using it a year. On the current map, it is a slightly confusing orange spaghetti of lines. Transport for London says the rebrand will make it easier for passengers to get around.
Graham Satchell. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Abby Wiltshire. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.